Where is Doc? I wonder if he's in his study. Doc? You in there? Doc? He's not here either. Oh, just look at the state of this study. Books and papers everywhere. What's this? Seems to be a set of blueprints. Operation Golden Age Time Machine? What on earth's he up to? There you are! What are you doing? What's that machine?
Oh, Mark. For the podcast's 10th birthday, I've decided to take us and the podcast back to a golden age. A cleaner, purer time. I've been experimenting with this time machine for a while, surely you've noticed.
Now you mention it, I did see a stegosaurus propping up the bar in the pub last week. I didn't think anything of it. You can't seriously be planning to throw time into reverse.
Am I not? If we take the County of Mummerset back in time, we can guide podcasting along a better path. We can give it a second chance.
Doc, please, step away from those controls.
Get off me!
Let go of that lever!
Nothing in the world can stop me now!
Oh!
Marco, Hayden, wherever you are, both our dear listeners, welcome to Jurassic Podcast. See, I told you it would work. We're back in prehistory.
How can we be? We're still in the Hooseum.
I told you it was a very old building, Mark. Now, is there any sign of life around? Hang on, is there someone sitting in that wing-backed armchair with its back to us?
Seems to be smoking.
It's a hooker.
How did she get in here?
A hooker, Mark. A Turkish pipe. Well, there's a hat here, and a scarf, and someone's left a note. Gone to lunch, back soon. And he signed it over the Prydonian seal. Go on, shoo, shoo, shoo! This handwriting looks strangely familiar. Who was living at the Hooseum in the distant past? Sorry, have you got my 5,000-year diary, Mark?
We'll find out soon enough. A souped-up go-kart has just drawn up outside the front door.
Is it Dick Dastardly in the Mean Machine?
Nope.
Professor Pat Pending in the Converter Car?
Nope.
Is it Penelope Pitstop in the Compact Pussycat?
No. Seems to be called The Zoom Rocket's Revenge.
Now that sounds familiar.
Hello, boys.
No. It can't be. Quick, Mark, the controls. There must be a reverse gear somewhere.
We can't go back to 2024 now. I sold my house.
Hang on. Pass me my pearl-handled opera glasses, would you, Mark? Oh, panic over. It isn't JR after all. It's the Rev!
Oh!
I didn't realise we'd travelled that far back in time.
Well, you did give that Helmick regulator quite a twist.
Come on. We'd better get this podcast started. Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 192 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Mark.
And I'm the Rev.
Rev!
Hello!
Good Lord!
Well, Anna, it's nice to see you.
By the Lord Harry.
By the Lord Harry. What an extraordinary coincidence that on the Diddly Dum podcast's 10th birthday, we should, entirely by accident, encounter none other, I say, than the Reverend Captain Hollow Porrow himself.
Well, you say no accident. It's all a con, listeners. It's because Rock found out my copyright was about to run out. And he said if I didn't come and do it myself, that he'd do a Beatles on me and have an artificially inseminated version of me instead.
Either that, or when we got the quote from the locksmith to change all the locks on the museum, we realised that we'd have to surrender to anyone who still had a set of keys.
Well,
well, listeners, those of you who've been with us from the start, as it were, will clearly be gazing around in awed wonder at those familiar tones which are coming out of your various forms of speakers and headphones. And Mark, you were one of those people, weren't you?
Yeah, well, who was a big fan, a listener, yes, very much so, in those early days. I said this must be how David Tennant felt when he walked onto the set of Time Crash.
Oh, too kind, Mark. Give me 25 quid, Mark, and I'll sign a photo for you.
Oh, you're just the same as all the rest, damn it. Never meet your heroes.
The Rev was, of course, one of the three original hosts of the Diddly Dum podcast back on the 15th of January-ish. 2014, was it?
Well,
that would be 10 years ago.
It was the January immediately after the 50th anniversary, wasn't it?
Well, not that immediate. Diddly Dum's never been the most immediate of podcasts, to be fair. Hence our review coming up later.
But I was just thinking, I was going to say, well, Rev, what have you been doing? But I think, unless we're expecting a five-hour podcast, we might have to do that as we're going along. Have you been keeping well, old chap?
Yeah, you know, can't complain, yeah. Still breathing.
Hang on, do I hear a noise coming from the direction of the museum kitchens? Oh, what a surprise! A 10th birthday cake.
Oh, isn't that lovely?
Oh.
Bring it in, boys. I hope Hayden's not going to jump out of this.
Again.
I hope it's Leela.
In the baggy jumper. So let's light the candles and we'll shall we all take one deep breath and blow them out together?
Ooh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay.
1, 2, 3. Oh no! They're relighting. What sorcerer's magic is this?
It says Nitro 9 on that one.
Right, well, what has been happening since we last broadcast a Diddly Dum podcast? Normally, when I, on a Christmas Day morning, the first thing that happens to me as I'm stirring from the depths of sleep is a knock on my bedroom door.
Oh, yeah.
When I've travelled back up to Manchester and my mother, old Marhoom herself, saying, Merry Christmas, would you like a cup of tea? This time it was, who's Dickie Franklin? And I said, I've no idea, who's Dickie Franklin? And she said, oh, it's something to do with Doctor Who. I said, do you mean Richard Franklin? Oh, what? I don't know, but on the radio they kept saying Dickie Franklin. Of course, on Christmas Day we lost the late lamented Richard Franklin,
who
didn't
we? Did, yeah. The captain.
The captain himself.
Yeah.
Mike! As the Brigadier shouts in Time Monster.
Does he?
Yeah, that's that when he thinks Captain Yates has been killed. It's the first time that the Brigadier kind of breaks with...
Oh, of course, yes.
...military protocol. And actually, he's so upset, he just shouts, Mike! Over the radio. It's a wonderful moment.
Yates, get out of it, man. It's a bomb. It's a bomb. Get out of it, Yates. Yates, can you hear me? Yates, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Over! Mike, can you hear me?
Bit amateur, isn't it? I've lost a bit of respect for the Brigadier now.
I think we'd known for a while that Richard had been hadn't been well, hadn't we? But it still came as a bit of a surprise. In fact, in summer 2019, we met him at Oldbourne, didn't we, Mark?
Yeah, he's one of the many actors from the Demons who'd come along that day. We've also lost Maurice Amon, obviously, since then as well, haven't we? And,
And
now we've lost Richard Franklin. So that only leaves Katie Manning and John Levine. I tried to get the word Ian out of my head there.
And that's Corporal Bell still knocking around. John Levine, who was one of the other guests at that event on the Village Green, who turned out to have, shall we say, a much wider grasp of basic Anglo-Saxon than we suspected he did, didn't he, Mark?
He was very much working from the Blue Book.
Yeah.
But, yes, anyway, Richard Franklin, yes. And he was lovely. I also met him at the Hoy Lake as well.
Oh, I didn't go to that, yes,
which was
of course.
In 2018, I think.
That was the time when, I think earlier that year, Mark had gone to one of the Sci-Fi by the Sea conventions at Herne Bay.
Yeah. Yes, in Kent, yeah.
Knowing that John Leeson was going to be there, and we thought, he'll be able to get his autograph. And so, knowing that John Leeson had played the original Bungle in Rainbow, Mark printed off a photo from the internet of John as one of the War Bungle. And he actually was happy to sign it for us, wasn't he? And so
it was
we thought,
lovely, yeah.
We thought, I wonder if we'll print off a photo of Richard Franklin dying on Emmerdale from being crushed by a bull. But I think at the end we didn't have the guts, did we?
No, well, pretty much the only photos you can find online of the event was an anonymous hand clutching the side of a cow.
He died of a surfeit of beef. I know it sounds silly, I know we joke now. But casting my mind back to those days, I can't entirely remember whether this was from the TV or mainly from Target books, but Mike and Benton and the Brigadier were almost like family, weren't they? Or is that me being overly nostalgic?
No, there was family-ish bits. There was like a brotherly thing going on, wasn't there? Because he... He nicked Benton's corned beef sandwich, didn't he, when he wanted to watch the rugby on BBC Three?
No, I meant both a family and part of your own family. Comforting presence that was always there.
Yeah, because I think it wasn't very military, was it? It was like popping to your uncle's house, wasn't it? There was only like three of them in there, and it just seemed inside. Dad's army seemed to be a better military setup, and they were in a village hall. These like were in some kind of bungalow with in a nice little kitchen, the telly on, you know, the scientific advisor there quaffing wine.
Manx using the doctor's Bunsen burner to make some cocoa. Don't panic! Anyway, I thought so with you, Richard. I was going to say wherever you are, but that's not very polite either, is it? Something else that's happened since Christmas is that they've released the intro to, season 15?
You mean the promo video? I bet that was a treat for you, wasn't it, Rev?
Oh, God, yeah. So exciting when that dropped. And the video. Yeah, I was quite surprised as well, because she's obviously very busy now. She's in Emmerdale Farm, come to kill a bull.
Oh, she is, isn't she? Yeah,
she is. So she's pretty busy, you know. So she managed to find time to shoot that. I mean, I have legally met her a couple of times. She never saw me the illegal times. She is always very gracious and very respectful of Doctor Who, and, you know, it's in her life and where it's led her and the relationship she's got out of it. So I think she would have wanted to give back to the fans with that, and it's great. And it's nice to see what Leela's been up to.
When did you actually meet her? Didn't you once tell us an anecdote of meeting her once?
Well, several times. Well, the first time was before, it must have been the 90s, and it was at the stage door of a matinee performance of, God, I'm going to Dad's Army again. It was a matinee performance of The Ghost Train, which was by Albert Ridley. And she was in that, and we used to hang around outside the stage door to meet these people, get their autographs and Vicky. And we met Louise Jason. She signed, this was even before Sharpies, she signed my copy of Robots of Death in, like, running out biro. And my mate who I was with, he'd said, oh, we love Doctor Who. It's got to come back, hasn't it? And she went, oh, I don't think so. It's had its day. But, you know, and then, of course, it did come back. And then the next time I met her after that was, I went to this would have been about 6 years ago. There was a signing in London, and it was Tom and Louise. And because I think I had enough money to either get Tom to sign something or get a photo, and I went for the photo because I had a few bits and bobs that I'd bought already signed by the pair of them. And I went and had a photo, and they were both really, really, really lovely. And then about 3 years ago, I actually interviewed Louise Jameson at Bridlington Comic Con on a panel where, so our panels at Bridlington Comic Con are a bit odd. So on the panel, we also had Colin Spall.
Oh, no.
No, not Colin, but Colin Spall and Jet from Gladiators. But that got me, you see, what happened there was, you see, I got to lead a great conversation with, you know, both Jet and Louise about, you know, how women were depicted on a Saturday tea time for many years, clad in leotards of leather or lycra, and, you know, how things have changed. Yeah, it was really good. She was really lovely. So I've been lucky enough to meet her a few times, and yeah, she's a wonderful person, and I'm very chuffed with the series, the 15 video. These little teaser videos have gradually got better and better, really. And I think with the advent of these Tales from the TARDIS things, they're sort of starting to tie in a little bit with the actual world of Doctor Who, this Whoniverse that they've said. There actually seems to be a little fit.
Yeah, Louise is great, isn't she? She's utterly charming as well. She's got proper star twinkle, and her eyes are just...
Oh, fabulously glamorous.
That was the thing that, when I was lucky enough to meet her at the Capitol convention, I mean, Doc was just supposed to go, she just radiates. it's something that other mortal people don't seem to have. I don't know. Maybe it's just my fan heart, but she just seemed absolutely compelling.
Tell you how gracious she was. So when, you know, you get these people at conventions and you pay them a guarantee, and if they make over that guarantee, then you basically get them for free. She didn't make her guarantee, and she apologised to us for not making her guarantee, and she said, I'll make up the shortfall in signed photos.
Oh.
So she just gave us this stack of photos, you know, to give out as prizes and gifts. So, yes, and they don't all do that. A lot of them, like, are counting the coppers, not naming names, but she was the exact opposite. You don't get that a lot.
Did I see a pic of you with Colin on stage once?
Yeah, that was the first Hull Comic-Con, I think, we had Colin
Baker.
It, yeah. Well, you can play Colin Baker bingo when you see him, because he tells the same anecdotes. but we actually made him sulk, which was a bit bad on our part. We didn't know he was allergic to cheese, and he had these cheese sandwiches, and he went and sat outside the green room and sulked because he didn't have any sandwiches.
Oh. My earliest memory ever is from the wonderful city of Hull.
Is it really?
It is. That's where my mum was born, and...
Oh, of course!
It has a habit of imprinting itself onto people's psyche.
And my mum took me to go and visit some of my relatives there. I was born in Cardiff, and mum was living in Cardiff at the time. And my mum took me to go and visit my great aunt, who lived in Hull.
Yeah.
I would have been about three, so this would have been about 1974. And I was being put to bed at my great aunt's house, and the radio was on in my room. And I remember it started playing. My mum went out and told me to get into bed and to get ready to go to sleep. And Tiger Feet came on, and I started bouncing up and down on bed really excitedly, jumping around, because I'd absolutely freaking loved Tiger Feet.
Yeah,
and I went nuts to it. I lost my soul to glam rock. And my mum came in furious, went, you're supposed to be in bed. And she turned the radio off like that. And honestly, I was so angry. And My mum went out of the room and she came in the morning and found that I'd drawn all over my great aunt's bedding. She brought me one of those big long packets of multi-coloured felt tip pens and I'd use them. I pretty much run them out by drawing all over the bedding and she had to go and buy some new ones and she was mortified. Wow. And that's the power of glam rock.
Crazy. Yeah, that's wild. You trashed your great aunt's bedroom.
Yes.
That's so rock and roll.
I used to resent Hull. Do you remember in the 70s? What were they called? Got to number one with Matchstock Men and Matchstock Cats and Dogs.
Was it Brian and Michael?
Brian and Michael, that was it.
And the St. Winifred's Choir, yeah.
If you're wondering why the focus on Hull, listeners, it's the family home of the Rev when he's not in the Hoosium. And, of course, L.S. Lowry, the artist, comes from my neck of the woods. And there's one of the lines which is, they said his works of art were dull. No room all round, the walls are full. But Lowry didn't care much anyway. And of course these are the days when you couldn't just, if you didn't catch, what was that line? You couldn't just go on Google and say, type in, what are the lyrics to this song? And I thought it said, for years, they said his works of art were dull, no room all round the walls of Hull. And I thought there was some anecdote from his past how when he wasn't quite famous, there was some art exhibition in Hull. But and they said, we're not having any Lowries. I thought, well, the snobbish things. But I
now they said his works of art were dull, no room all at the walls are full, but Lowry didn't care much anyway. They said he just paints cats and dogs and matchstock men in boots and clogs, and Lowry said that's just the way they'll stay.
Your anger at the snobbery was based on an anecdote invented by yourself.
I know.
Nothing's changed, Rev.
You must have worked that out by now. I was just thinking that about me saying, but haven't you been on the stage with Colin? Does this come across as me Joe Grant in Death of the Doctor in the Sarah Jane Adventures, where it turns out, I know, the Doctor the other way around, isn't it? A doctor's been secretly keeping an eye on all his old companions.
Yeah.
For years. I've been secretly keeping an eye on all my old co-hosts all the time. Trying to, you were saying you went to get Tom and Louise's signature.
Yeah.
Do you remember Al's long anecdote about how he travelled down by coach from the far north to the stamp centre in the Strand?
That's right, yeah.
To get Tom's, because I think it was around about the time when we were all thinking, I mean, considering this was 10 years ago, we were already thinking that we could die soon.
Yeah, yeah.
And he took with him one of those full-size cardboard stand-up cutouts of Tom on the coach and stood in the queue, got him to sign it. Happy days, happy days. One thing about it, I think that's, is it season 15?
Yes.
This Blu-ray box set? I think it's called The Final Battle by Pete McTighe. And one of the things I did think is, Pete McTighe, I thought it might have been written by Murray Gold, whose lyrics we'll get onto later, because one of the lines is, Leela says to the Daleks, while we live, your victory is short-lived. And I thought, you can put live twice in the same sentence. I just thought it was a bit strange, really.
She was a savage.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. When I was watching that, I was sat there. And sometimes I can be a bit cynical. I was sat there going, oh, this is all very cheesy, isn't it, really? I mean, it's nice to see Louise Jameson and stuff. And I was thinking, but some of this is a bit cheesy. But then, but then she suddenly appears in the Fourth Doctor's TARDIS. And He looks up from the console, and I genuinely felt tears prickling my eyes. And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's funny how I'd gone from, well, yeah, whatever, and then suddenly like, oh, my God.
It was a bit nice to see black and grey Daleks.
Yeah, don't they look? They look great, yeah. Don't they? I was thinking that.
I've seen people do it online, you know, themselves, but to actually see them
yeah.
is great.
Is that guy, is it JJ? Is that his initials? Jamie Johnson? Oh, I can't remember now. But there's a guy who's been redesigning lots of Daleks, hasn't he? And for, he does them a lot for Big Finish covers and stuff. And,
oh, yes, I know the guy. He did the stained glass one.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, and I think he may have done the ones for that. I'm not sure. That black and grey one definitely looked like one of his. It was, they look great in different colours.
I was just going to add that the one bit I don't understand is why is Leela just on a cliff watching, you know, the capital being bombed?
Maybe she was enjoying it.
Yeah, I know. She did seem to be. I did thought she was watching it like the New Year's fireworks.
I'm just thinking back to the days of the Rev on the podcast. Just remember, God, if not only did the Rev come up with the name of the podcast, when I was thinking of things like, oh, would it be rather witty to call it something like Analog Time or something? And Rev just said, don't diddly dum, because then it will fit into the Tom Baker Diamond logo with a six-letter word followed by a three-letter word.
And now the new series has ripped off the diddly dum logo.
I know, the jammy sods. But you just have to suspend your suspension of disbelief for a second, listeners. He also came up with the idea of the Hooseum.
Really? Oh.
Yeah.
Previously on Diddly Dum.
Tonight is the opening night of this interesting thing that we find ourselves virtually within, perhaps, who can say. Rev, it was your idea largely to come here for this opening ceremony, so would you mind telling the wonderful people?
Well, I think there's dear listeners to thank, really, because we had some lovely messages of people who obviously got onto our wavelength and knew we liked things and sent us links to beautiful objects. Gary Whip sent us something, I think we'll talk about him later, and Kevin sent us some beautiful things. And we thought, well, these need to be showcased. So what we've got here, ladies and gentlemen, is the Hooseum, where we're going to gradually build up a collection of marvellous things linked to the series Doctor Who, and it's nothing like that programme on radio.
And in podcast 11, when we had the gala opening night of the Hooseum, I introduced my do-it-yourself Dalek kit. I don't remember that.
Oh, that was joyous, yeah.
And Al introduces 18 seconds from Father's Day. That is where Rose's dad is staring out of the window of the church and realises what he has to do to put everything back right. Oh, I remember. The do-it-yourself Dalek kit from my childhood was where you take a largish supermarket cardboard box, cut a hole in two opposite sides and a hole in the bottom, and then put it over your head, stick your arms out through the holes in the sides, and go around and say exterminate. And as ever, faithless listeners, you can find links to photos, videos, and more information on almost everything that we discuss on the Diddly Dum podcast at our podcast blog, which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. And Rev, and this is going to be a test for you, Rev, introduced his record collection countdown. From number 10, can you remember any of them?
I did think about it not so long back when Joe Wiley did that Doctor Who concert thing. I think either the night before or the night after, she'd said phone in with some obscure Doctor Who record references, if you like. And I did think, well, the one that I do remember was Eye on the Walrus was a corker.
That was number one.
Because not only does Patrick Troughton cover it in The Three Doctors, the superior version of the song, I believe. It's got, when the radio sounds in it are being tuned in, in one of the bits of it. It's a Shakespeare play featuring Roger Delgado.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it is.
So there's that. What else was there? It was Bonnie Langford's album, I think.
Now by Bonnie Langford.
Madam Butterfly.
Yeah.
Which was in the TV movie. Was there one of Don Pertwee's saucy shanties, sea shanties? I have got that record.
That wasn't in... Oh, it didn't make the top 10 anyway.
There was one that... I don't know if it actually mentioned the Daleks, or was it called Invasion of the Robots or something? Because it had a good anecdote with it.
Oh, well done. Landing of the Daleks by the Earthlings.
It's got Morse code at the beginning of it. So the BBC banned it because at the time you weren't allowed to broadcast Morse code on the BBC in case...
Oh, right.
The military thought it was a real invasion. I can't remember anymore. Was the Absalom Dark featuring the Stranglers on it?
No.
Is that featuring the Stranglers?
Well,
with their flexi disc.
Yeah, they basically spent all the money that was ever made from that because it came out. It was on a 12-inch as well. They called themselves the Slaves of Cain.
Oh, yeah, it's Peaches, isn't it?
It was yeah. Do, do, do,
yeah,
do,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, of course.
So, what were the Stranglers fans of Absalom Dark?
No. It was by Dominic Glynn.
Oh, right.
And he sampled that on it, and then they had to pay royalty.
Let's do the top 10 countdown. The Revs Record Collection Countdown, which he presented to the Hooseum on its opening night. At number 10, we have John Smith and the Common Men. Number 9, it's Doctor Who by Jeff Love. At number 8, it's Landing of the Daleks by the Earthlings. At number 7, it's Madam Butterfly by Puccini.
Mm-hmm.
In at number 6, it's Tom Baker by the Human League.
Oh, yeah.
Getting in at number 5, Doctor in Distress by Who Cares.
Yeah, that was the Dad Books fizz on it.
At number 4, it's How Long Does a Tear Take to Dry by the Beautiful South. What's that got to do with Doctor Who?
Because it's got the lyric in it, her heart was like a TARDIS.
Oh, Rick Cash. At number 3, it's Honey to the Bee by Billy.
Oh, Billy.
I've forgotten her name.
Just Billy.
At number 2, it's Now by Bonnie Langford. And at number 1, it's I Am the Walrus by the Beatles.
Goo 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 goo.
So, anything interesting happened over Christmas? I don't get any exciting presents or anything. I made the mistake a few years ago of saying to my family, if you want to get me anything, don't give it to me, give it to, and then this particular charity that gives books to children in care. So I get nothing these days.
Well.
I have started reading. I came across, has anyone read any of the Slough House books by Mick Herron?
No.
It's a series of sort of slightly ironic spy novels, which has now become... a very good series with Gary Oldman on Amazon. It's interesting anyway. Links in the show notes, of course, listeners. We are taking the opportunity, he said, suddenly realised that the whole conceit of this is that we only accidentally bumped into the Rev today, to talk about the Christmas Day special, The Church on Ruby Road. Just to catch up a bit, Rev, what did you think of the three specials leading up to Christmas Day?
Do you know what? It sort of changed the way I felt about the Christmas one as well. You know, it worried me about it. I was a bit worried about those three specials. You know, I didn't really. Well, I knew why they were doing them because it was the anniversary, and yeah, I'd rather they made Doctor Who than not make Doctor Who. But I just thought it was a bit odd going back to David Tennant when they had this whole new beginning just round the corner. And I was thinking, well, we have the same opening titles. Will there be? Will it be a bubble? I don't know what it's going to be. I don't understand. And they were very much, you know, Russell T. Davies, Tennant, Catherine Tate episodes. It was how it was. They had the same feel about it. Obviously, there was a lot more budget held in it. But then I thought it was odd that they introduced things like the new TARDIS set in it and the new logo and everything. And I think it's sort of a bit it was a bit weird that they had the regeneration in it, because if this was going to be going out on Disney, this was going to be a lot of people, and they're calling it Series 1, the new one. It's obviously a sort of reboot of sorts. This was almost a bit like the TV movie in that, well, why are you starting it with a regeneration? They need to watch it until they're 8 years old and then sit there crying when Tom Baker turns into a vet. You know, you don't start off with that knowledge. I just thought it was a bit of an odd thing to do. Yes, I enjoyed them, especially the Toymaker one. I really loved that. And I did like the idea of these, that they made him more of this godlike type of bad guy, hadn't they? Almost like a Star Trek villain, which I think is a nice, slightly different way to be going. So I did enjoy that. But yeah, as much as I enjoyed them, I thought they were an odd thing to do.
I think it was the needs of, should we say, the needs of the franchise, maybe taking over the needs of the storytelling, wasn't it? I think it was Russell clearly thinking, I've got to do something to get people interested in the show again.
Oh, it definitely did that, didn't it? Yeah.
Rather than thinking, oh, this would be the most amazing story to tell. I can't remember. What was your general opinion of David and Catherine in their original incarnations?
I was never a massive David Tennant fan as much as a lot of people were. I always preferred Matt Smith, really. So I didn't really bond with him. I do like Catherine Tate, and I liked the character as well. And they worked well together. And there was some great stories, some not so great stories. But in the long run, I don't think it's the greatest era of Doctor Who, but probably the easiest one that they were able to then put back on TV.
Yes, yes.
And they all clearly loved doing it. And I can't deny the joy at seeing Bernard Cribbins for the last time.
That was lovely, wasn't it?
Yeah. Were you not delighted to see the Star Beast come out of the comic strip and appear on the telly?
Yeah, I did, but why did they suddenly start calling it just The Meep rather than Beep The Meep? I don't know. But yeah, I did like that, yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, my sister, now, never in her life has she ever watched a full episode of Doctor Who voluntarily. She's only seen a couple, and her boyfriend watches Doctor Who, and she'll usually, when it's on, she'll go and do something else, or, it'll be on when she's out or gone to bed. But those specials, that's the first time that she sat down and watched The Star Beast with her boyfriend, just because she'd heard about Russell T Davies coming back and there'd been so much promotion of it. And it started piquing her interest a bit, I think. And she actually sat down, watched all of The Star Beast and absolutely loved it. And she messaged me afterwards going, I like Doctor Who now. I was like, what?
Yeah.
You mean all these years?
Similar experience. I viewed it with someone who I don't think had watched it since the 70s and had said, do you know, I think there's something in this Doctor Who.
Yeah, but and she's watched every episode now, and she's had these big long conversations with me when I meet her for coffee and stuff. She was like, oh, let's talk about the Christmas episode and stuff. It's like, oh, okay, this is new.
So, The Church on Ruby Road, broadcast on Christmas Day, written by, of course, the new showrunner, Russell T Davies, directed by Mark Tondorai, who I think directed Rosa and the Ghost Monument. Hang on, I'll just flip my three-sided Martian coin. Mark, do you want to pick us off?
Yeah, I can do, yeah. Now, the first thing I want to say was, when I was sitting down to watch this, I suddenly felt really excited, and this almost felt like the freshest start that we've had to Doctor Who since it returned in 2005, this kind of... I know we've seen the specials, which kind of gave us bits of old and bits of new all jumbled up together. But this start of a new story with a new Doctor, it just felt like the biggest difference that we've had in years. Because, I mean, the Jodie Whittaker era didn't feel tremendously different. Well, I mean, there was lots of things different, but do you know what I mean? It felt like a continuation of the Peter Capaldi era, so to speak. And this just felt completely fresh. And I was really excited sitting down to watch it, and I was delighted to have it back on Christmas Day. And then it started, and I don't know. Millie, I find okay. She's all right. I don't know. She hasn't done loads in the episode to kind of make me go one way or the other. But the main thing for me was Shooty. I just said, it's just fantastic. I absolutely adore him. I think for me, He's the most utterly charming and compelling Doctor we've had since Matt Smith. Because I remember watching The 11th Hour and just being like, oh, I love this man. He's so good. I don't mean to slag off the previous incumbent of the role. Well, the one before David Tennant. But the charisma levels just don't compare, really. I mean, Jodie's quietly charming and she's a good actress and does her thing. But Shooty's charisma is off the scale, really. And he just looks great. You've seen all the photos of him that have popped up online, and we've seen the trailer for the new series as well, when he's like in his 60s gear with his afro and everything. The guy just looks great. He looks cool as, and I love his little tash and stuff. And he's just, from that moment where you see him running along the rooftop, hurdling the chimneys, chimney pots or whatever it is. Yeah, I just thought, oh, this is great. And it totally won me over. So I'm really hoping that the stories kind of live up to it. I think with this story, it was perfectly judged and weighted for a Christmas Day episode. I thought it didn't really put a foot wrong. It had, you know, little bits of like tugging at your emotions, had the adventure. It had absolute shovelfuls of silliness that normally I would be sickened by to my... But for some reason, it just seemed to work for me, even that song. Don't know what anyone else thought about that song, but it didn't bother me at all. It just felt fine for Christmas Day. I could imagine loads of kids sitting around watching it who maybe hadn't watched Doctor Who before, just going, oh, this is great. The story, like I say, not brilliant, but Shooty, excellent, and it did what it needed to do for Christmas Day.
Initial thoughts, Rev?
Pretty similar. So one of the things I did like about it is that it's a bit like the reboot in 2005. The Doctor's already there. He's established. He's in his costume. He's on a mission. He's up to stuff.
Yes, yeah.
He's doing stuff. So there's been a gap, and I like that. So we have got that reboot that I feared wouldn't be there. So I enjoyed that bit. Again, Shooty, he's a brilliant actor and he's brilliant as the Doctor. I'm a bit worried he might be a little bit too cool and a bit too showy offy. I'm not sure if I'm going to enjoy the bit where he was a bit Sherlockian and Eighth Doctor, where he told the policeman that he knew what his girlfriend was going to say about the wedding ring. Maybe that's the engagement ring. Maybe that's a bit me being a bit cynical, but I hope that maybe he doesn't do that too much. But yeah, he's brilliant. Millie is a graduate of Coronation Street and played a brilliant character in Corrie. And when she left, I thought, oh, it's a shame because she's a good character. She had quite a couple of tough stories and you think, oh, she's going to be good. And when she was announced as the companion, I thought, oh, that's going to be great as well. Of course, the Davina thing was bizarre and fun, wasn't it? I mean,
I hate to say it, but I was really disappointed that it wasn't left, like, we didn't know whether or not she lived or survived.
No.
I liked the kind of idea that maybe the BBC killed her on Christmas Day. It appealed to me.
There was another thing I was excited about, and something I learned afterwards, was this idea that they were going to start bringing more fantasy elements into Doctor Who. I've never understood why they didn't do stories like that and why everything had to be brought back to science. Or I've often wondered, why can't we just have a ghost story where it's a ghost? So I'm glad that they did this goblin thing. I liked the way that they sort of said he was learning the language of string, because that was their physics and what they had instead of electric and wires. I thought that was really clever. So I liked all that bit, and I loved the set of the goblin's ship. Matt, I had one problem with the song. I like the song being in it, and I don't have an issue with the song being in it. And I think it's been a long time coming. You know, there's been a musical episode of Buffy and they've done a Star Trek one now recently, so I was up for that. My problem with it is the second part of it, where the Doctor and Millie are singing, works better because the backing music reflects the instruments the goblins are playing. The bit where the goblins are singing, it's very obvious that it's Murray Gold and his orchestra that are doing the backing track.
Oh, right, yeah.
And if it was just, I know it's fun and it's Christmas Day, but if it had just been a little bit more like, I don't know, the band in Jabba's Palace in Star Wars don't sound like John Williams. So I think it would have been nice to be taken out of that a little bit. The one thing I've heard since that's made me excited about what's to come, there was another show on over Christmas, Imagine, the arts documentary series with Alan Yenton.
Yeah. Mm.
He interviewed Russell T. Davis, and it came to why he's come back to Doctor Who, and it's partly because of It's a Sin, which was a TV drama.
Yes.
Raised a lot of attention and awareness about, you know, what the AIDS epidemic had actually been like in the 1980s. And he said it was great to be able to tell a story like that and make people aware of things. And he thought that Doctor Who was going to be a great vehicle to be able to do that. And it is very important to all sorts of different people. So if that's going to be a thing moving forward, then that's great.
Yeah, can I just talk about representation as well? Because I do think it is really important. I mean, even like if I go back like 10 years ago in my Twitter feed, there would have just been pretty much loads of mostly people who were very similar to me, a bunch of you know, white, straight males and stuff.
Mm.
Whereas now my Twitter feed is just an absolute a riot of various genders, sexualities, et cetera, et cetera. And where 10 years ago, I would have been sort of like, oh, I'm not really, those aren't my people. Why should I'm not really interested necessarily. Not, I don't mean this in a nasty way, but like, you know, sort of like, oh, what they're saying isn't necessarily relevant to me. Whereas now, through exposure, I've become just more used to seeing these people. Mm. I don't think twice about it now. So as a result, it's making me a better person.
I think he was talking about how sort of this is, you know, it's hit the ground running, this new series, and, you know, it's a very different feeling. And the last few series of Doctor Who, what's happened is it's not really changed shape since 2005, and that is quite a long time ago now. And obviously what It's a Sin did has given, it gave TV a kick up the bum, and people have realised what power it has, and it was time for a change again. And it'll put time for a change again in another few years, but I hope that they don't let it just stagnate, really. And I say the power of TV, I mean, look at what's happened with the post office scandal.
Yeah.
Who knows what could happen with TV shows moving forward? And, you know, Doctor Who could be one of those.
Yeah, and people say, like, broadcast linear TV is dead, but it's just, it really isn't.
No.
Yeah, so in future Doctor Who series, there could be an outcry in Parliament saying, why did the cyber leader get given a CBE?
Yeah.
I had to think, Mark, when you said I'd like to say something about representation, I was going to say, look, Mark, be satisfied. You've got Stefan on Unleashed. You can't have Welshmen all over the place.
It's the Welsh Mafia.
Yeah. What was the point he was making with the It's a Sin thing? Was he thought that now that television had moved on a bit, he would be able to be a bit nearer the knuckle with Doctor Who writing?
I don't think it's about being near the knuckle. I think it's about bringing people's attention to things.
Right, yeah.
It's a Sin was the first time, I think, since Doctor Who, where it was absolutely everywhere. It was the national conversation. I think that Russell went, oh, yeah, I remember this feeling. Imagine now being able to be this political, being this influential again. Back at Doctor Who, it's the best toy set you can have. It's the most incredible power because you've got all of time and space, but it's a kid's show, and that's the power of it. If you make that show right, whatever you put in that show, that generation are going to grow up with as part of their belief system. You are going in there at a really key age and teaching kids what a decent human being is. Which is another reason why I'm really looking forward to seeing this Doctor Who coming, because it's like, he's got work to do.
It was actually Caitlin Moran speaking on that clip.
It's interesting. I was thinking, a couple of years ago, my job, you know, I work with, you know, 16 to 18-year-old kids, teaching them, and a couple of years ago, I could start saying to people, oh, do you know, about 10% of my group now are trans. And I was thinking today, I'm thinking, I don't know the percentage now. I've just got a group of really lovely human beings, all different, and it's amazing. And I think it just, you know, I got that knowledge because I work with these people every day.
Yeah.
There are lots of people, you know, I could sit watching Doctor Who with some of them. I meet people down the pub, don't know that. They don't actually know what's going on with the next generation of people that are coming through. And Russell T. Davis does. And if he can make people aware, it can only be beneficial.
Of course, there is a problem in what you say, Rev, because if it's true that the next generations of Doctor Who fans currently growing up are composed largely of really lovely human beings. Where on earth are we going to find the podcasters of the future? I mean, we could find ourselves still doing this in our 80s.
Oh, dear.
I'm not going to be left out of this modern man thing. The recent drama about the post office scandal has also opened my eyes to the less advantaged in society. It's the first time I've watched anything on ITV for years. I was thrilled. Have either of you watched Sex Education?
I haven't.
Well, I tried watching it. I didn't get past a couple of episodes, but I wish I had persevered with it, because I've seen various actors from it when they've done speeches at awards ceremonies, etc. And they've obviously got a really good rapport together, and so I'm guessing the casting and the pace of it would have been brilliant.
I mean, you know me, I've never paid much attention to credits. And so when they said, oh, the new Doctor Who's been announced, it's this Nkuti Gatwa. So I Googled him, and my immediate thing was, oh, it's Eric from Sex Education. I was absolutely thrilled by it. I mean, I had a slight wobble at seeing his excerpt from Romeo and Juliet at the Coronation Concert. I thought briefly, oh dear, was Sex Education a one-off for him? And then I thought, maybe it could be like Chris Chibnall writing your lines for you. And he'll be on firmer ground delivering lines by a genius like Russell T. Davies instead of this, what's he called, William Shakespeare, is he?
Yeah.
And I was right. I loved him. And his performance right from the start. He's sort of by turns, both joyous and brooding.
Mm.
And it all seems to come from the same place. It isn't what I call light switch acting, which is, no, I'm acting silly. No, I'm acting seriously. No, I'm being silly. No, I'm being serious. He's like Tom in a way, which is he's simultaneously intense and barking. And I never think he's not the Doctor. Mind you, I thought when Jodie was announced, I thought, they can't have a female Doctor. But 24 hours after that announcement, I completely thought of her 100% as the Doctor. So I don't think I've anyone thought of anyone not like that, as not being the Doctor. And yes, we have to see what's coming later this year, but they've clearly decided to allow him to give in to the sort of crazy Eric side of his personality in Sex Education, which is quite a much less camped-up version. And his accent doesn't get in the way at all. I wondered if it might. In fact, quite the opposite, in fact, because it's clearly so much him that it almost reinforces the character he's playing. In fact, if they tried to get him, you know, like they did with David, if they tried to get him to do a generic English accent for fretting about what might people think in the audience, it could well have been a barrier to his acting.
It's quite flexible, isn't it? Like you say, like Tom, there were certain lines that I thought were amazing, like the one where Millie was trying to kick a door down on the ship, and it was the, do you mind? I'm trying to work out string theory. It's like that. And then there's other bits where when he popped up to the goblins and just went, hiya!
Yes.
It's sort of, you know, it's his brain's almost moving faster than his mouth, isn't it? It's great.
Yes.
I really liked the line that they even have their own equivalent of ventilation shafts.
It
was brilliant.
Sometimes after a new episode, I will Google the episode, but I'll do it on, say, Google News, just to see what reviews are going in the papers. And I did that sort of midway between Christmas and New Year just to see. And whereas normally it would be The Guardian, The Independent, The Times, The Telegraph, most of the ones at the top of the list this time were The Los Angeles Times. Which I think clearly, I think, is an impact of Disney. And I think in the Los Angeles Times they said, Shute is clearly not here on account of his colour or his sexual orientation, but because he's young, fit and sexy and radiates joy. And I thought, my God, the very criteria we use to select hosts and guests on the Diddly Dumb podcast. You're right, he's also an amazing clothes horse, and he seems to be able to look good in any outfit.
Mm.
Admittedly, what a criterion we had to drop from the podcast very early on for ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think you're right, Rev, it helps that his character is right there from the start. Mm. We've not had to go through, two episodes of him being carried around in a cupboard in a post-regen trauma. which can be interesting, but it seems to be something that they used to do. It's just been regeneration. We've got to do this trauma thing rather than, oh, we'll do it because we've thought of an interesting way, new way of doing it.
Well, I that's one of the reasons why the specials are so good, isn't it? Because they finished with basically saying, right, all that baggage and trauma and stuff that the Doctor carries around, that the new regeneration starts off with, so it has to go through. Suddenly, he's actually left dealing with it off screen so that this Doctor can fly, if you like.
Mm. Really fresh, yeah.
And so I thought my reaction was, finally, I'm going to... We never really got on with the Jodie Chibnall era, but I thought, finally, I'm going to really enjoy Doctor Who again and look forward to a new series instead of slightly dreading it as a tiresome chore that goes with doing the podcast. And even watching it on Christmas Day after Christmas lunch, even old Ma Hoom herself enjoyed it.
Wow.
My mother and actually asked at the end, oh, when's it next on? I was quite disappointed when I said, oh, not until May.
But, I mean, to us Doctor Who fans, just having to wait until May after the last few years' worth of delays and stuff, you know, that seems really soon, doesn't it?
It's nothing, is it?
It'll be on us before we know it.
What about, can we say, Mrs. Brian May?
What's this?
Mrs. Flood.
Anita Dobson. She's Brian May's wife.
She's not.
What do you mean she's not? Yeah, did you not know this?
You've not been keeping up with the latest pop music news, Doc.
Oh, you know I know nothing about her.
Brian May produced Anita Dobson's 1986 album.
Yep.
Well, imagine my embarrassment. Whose brother were you telling us a few months ago, Mark, had invited you on the stage to play bass?
No, he hadn't. It was Algie Ward from the Dan's brother had seen me playing bass in a pub and brought me a beer and was very complimentary. I think that's what you're referring to.
That's it. And you were telling me that story, and I was thinking, so he'd seen you playing bass in the pub.
Yeah.
And while you were telling us this story, in my mind, I pictured you in a pub standing up with a double bass. And so you know already that I know nothing about rock music and pop music.
I was drinking bass in a pub.
Talking of rock music, did you see
lovely bass
on social media last week or so, David Bowie and Parkinson talk about the first time you saw Mick Jagger?
No.
Get your hair cut! Did you not see that?
That did not, no.
It's really funny.
I saw a good clip of Emu attacking Bill Oddie, which I'd never seen before.
David Bowie's on Parkinson talking about the first time he saw the Stones in 1963.
Saw him first in 1963, I think it was, and I think it might have been at the Brixton Odeon. I don't know, somebody remember the tour. Everybody remembers everything these days. And the Rolling Stones were opening up for him. It's the first time they ever saw him. And they weren't really very well known. There's about six kids rushed to the front, you know. That was their fan base at the time. Everybody was there for Little Richard. And I think Bo Diddley was on the show and all that. And it was priceless. I'd never seen anything so rebellious in my life. Some guy yells out, "Get your hair cut!" And Mick says, and I'll never forget these words, "What, I look like you?" I thought, oh my God, this is the future of music.
So in the same way that you say, Mark, your sister has never watched an episode of Doctor Who voluntarily.
Yeah.
I mean, that was us for quite a few years, wasn't it?
It kind of was, yeah.
We hadn't reviewed an episode of Doctor Who voluntarily for quite some time.
God, I saw some of those episodes three times as well, because I'd watched them once on broadcast, and then I'd go over to my friend's house and they'd watch an episode. I'm watching with them and their children. And then I'd have to rewatch it and make notes for the podcast. And by the time I got through three viewings, it was, oh, man, it's hard work. So I've just realised I've got something in common with Emu then, because I also have attacked Bill Oddie.
You haven't.
Of course.
Although, admittedly, mine was accidental.
In a canary yellow jumpsuit.
Yes, that's right, yes. I knocked him to the floor in there.
That's brilliant.
I can't remember whether it was Tower Records or whether it was the Virgin Megastore in London. But yes, we were looking through the record racks, me and my friend, and he was over the other side of the shop. And he suddenly started beckoning me over and going, look, and pointing to the record racks just round the other side from him. And I went charging round there to see what he was pointing at. And what I hadn't seen, because he's quite short, was that there was a man there. As I went hearing round the side of this record rack, I bowled this poor man to the floor. And there he was, sprawled on the floor in his canary yellow jumpsuit. It was Bill Oddie.
Wow.
Bless him. Still, he seems all right now.
I'm quite a sucker for all the Christmassy stuff. When you see the things like Doctor Unleashed, and you can see how they've made it look like fake snow, and they tell you actually it's all bits of paper and something. Mm. But you still, when you actually see it as the episode, I'm still completely enthralled by that sort of Christmas episode. Even though I don't think we've had a white Christmas for years.
Mm. I even think that it demonstrates how good these people are at acting.
Because, oh, yeah.
You know, if you was stood in the middle of a load of paper and, you know, next to a rubber goblin that stank of glue, you wouldn't be thinking, my God, this is amazing, it's snow and a goblin. They're making that believable for us as well, so I think that's amazing.
Have we any thoughts who it was who left Ruby on the church doorstep?
Not really. I try not to turn myself inside out thinking of theories like this anymore, because they either end up being wrong or if they are a little bit right, then I'm vaguely disappointed. So I don't read spoilers as much as I used to now. I like to be surprised and entertained.
You're very similar to Mrs. Flood, which we got lost from.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought it might be her. At the end, after they'd destroyed the goblin ship, and Shooty put her back down on the doorstep, I thought, oh, is it going to be like a time loop, as it was him all along? But then he looks up and he sees whoever it was walking away, doesn't he?
Mm.
Do we have any thoughts on who Mrs. Flood might be?
God knows. I presume she's benevolent, because she seems
yes.
Nice. I did wonder why they got Anita Dobson in to do such a small role, really, because she seemed quite a big name just to be, like, the neighbour.
Mm. Mm.
The only thought I had, and this was, see, I said I don't do these things anymore. She's called Flood, and we'd been told that there were going to be more biblical God-style entities coming into the series after the Toymaker. I did wonder if she'd be like one of the horsemen of the apocalypse, you know, bringing Flood.
Oh, right.
I did wonder that.
I was thinking, is it connected with river or pond?
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously Susan or the Brownie, isn't it? That's the...
Yeah. I did think the thing at the end, haven't you ever seen a TARDIS before, was very like, you know where at the end of, is it The Impossible Astronaut, where the little girl who's coughing in the alley suddenly starts regenerating?
Oh, yeah.
As the credits are going up and you think, wow!
Mm. Mm.
Love things like that. Carla's got an enormous flat, hasn't she?
The kitchen. What's going on there?
I know! It's huge!
It could be a TARDIS.
Oh.
So is that Susan and the Rani living in the upstairs in the flat, and then that's Romana is outside?
I've given up all that stuff, and I'm back with you guys for, you know, an hour, and I'm back imagining all sorts of...
We've pulled you back in.
Yeah.
For one last job.
I was a little surprised that once the Big Red Button had been pressed and the time had been reset, that... the cracks in the ceiling of the flat hadn't been repaired, so I wonder if... I did think they were great. I loved Cherry, the grandma in bed, flirting with them.
Mm.
That was quite... you know where in Rose, where Jackie's flirting with the doctor? Oh, there's a strange man in my bedroom. Oh, I think it worked a lot better.
Talking about the flat, there's that one scene in it as well, isn't there, where Ruby's disappeared, and I think it's really well acted and played... and directed scene. It's just, you know, Ruby's disappeared and her mum's there with Lulabelle, and she sat there with this baby, and she's, I don't know, there's something about the filter or something they've put on. The actress does this thing with her eyes where she looks kind of dead inside. And
yes,
having gone from that warm, bubbly woman and see all the warmth and everything sucked out of that flat, There's something about that I remember watching at the time, and I spotted very early on that the photographs had gone from the fridge.
Mm.
And just, I felt my stomach literally sinking. I felt slightly sick. It was so brilliantly done, that kind of darkness. It was genuinely affecting.
I like Ruby, Millie Ruby. I'm not sure she's had enough to do there to, you know, to think, because she's not got, in a way, I suppose it might be easier when you're doing a slightly heightened, over-the-top performance like Shooty does. It might actually be easier than if you're effectively playing a normal character, just making, delivering standard lines. Very impressed by the Doctor dancing his tank top and kilt.
Oh, yeah.
He almost throws better shapes than our Mark does.
Well, you've seen him.
The giant snowman falling off the edge of the building, which was the Henricks, wasn't it? You remember the...
Yeah.
Department store that Rose used to work in.
What's it?
It's apparently a tribute to something that used to be in Manchester every year until they put scaffolding all over the town hall to redo it, is that every year they had a colossal inflatable Santa grasping the clock tower of Manchester Town Hall between his legs. And apparently Russell's admitted that this was a tribute to that.
So I invented this with the falling snowman. In the very first draft of the script, there was a sequence here of decorations falling, so... I feel like I should shut up now. Mary, love. It's great, isn't it?
It's so good. It's like the Manchester...
It's based on the Manchester Santa. That's what I thought of.
Really?
They said, what can you do? What can a disaster do? And Manchester Town Hall, faithful listeners, has a giant Santa in lots of different shapes over the years that's been strapped to the Town Hall clock. And I thought of that. That's literally what inspired it. Mm. I love this woman with the pram. She's
I did love, I thought it was really funny, physical comedy, when they, just before they all jump on the ladder and they do the whole thing about these magic gloves. Millie's on the ladder, so the Doctor's just running along the roof, jumping over chimneys, and he's looking sideways at her, so he's not looking at the chimneys, he's just vaulting them.
Yes.
He's very, very good. Oh, this is really going to be good. Well, going back to what I was saying about Murray Gold's lyrics with...
Now, then Russell T. Davies wrote the lyrics.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
Oh, no, that's interesting, because... They reminded me of the lyrics to, do you remember Stowaway? The song they released to go with the...
Oh, I love that song. It's on one of my Christmas playlists, yeah.
Oh, it's a lovely song to go with the... Voice of the Damned. There's a lack of lines. Once I found a stowaway upon my ship on Christmas Day, I was fair, so I gave him a chance. You shouldn't be here. What's your tale? I ought to throw you to the whale. And I thought, that is a line so clunky that Chris Chibnall could have written it. Yeah, I ought to throw you to the whale. Now, you might say, throw you to the sharks. Or, I mean, you wouldn't throw someone to the whales, would you? Because whales are supposed to be nice creatures. But even then, the whale, it would have to be like the beast below, where there's actually a whale in space to do that.
Once I found a stowaway upon my ship on Christmas Day, I was fair, so I gave him a chance. You shouldn't be here, what's your tale? I ought to throw you to the whale.
And that's when I actually started concentrating on a second watch on the lyrics to this The Goblin song. Babies had such very bad luck. Now into baby we will tuck. You know the sort of lines that people construct in a desperate attempt to avoid ending a sentence with a preposition? Up with this we will not put. Now baby's salted, she's a treat. Her destiny, it's time to meet. Bloody hell. And he finishes with the things that the Goblin King likes eating. 500 puppies with golden fur.
We are meant to believe this is written by goblins, though, not Bob Dylan.
Orphan boys with jet black hair. Circus clowns with a red balloon. He can eat me, he makes me swoon. And I just thought, dear, you're going to release that into the charts. You can't write lines like that. Something that's clearly going, I think, is going to be significant and is slightly depressing for those of us who'd hoped. beyond hope that RTD was going to ditch the whole timeless child thing. Unless that was a matter of great joy for you, Rev.
Well, I prefer to go along the continuity that is half-human, obviously. And called Doctor Who.
I thought it was interesting that when I first saw the original trailer for this, I thought, oh, the goblins are all CGI. But actually, it turns out they're like...
I know.
Beat the Meep and the Wrath Warriors. They're actually people, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm finding this really interesting at the moment, that the join between... It's the same with, the Meep. It's the join between CG and physical is seamless. When you think about... Do you remember when we've had the Slovene and you had a front shot of them running or bimbling along like, the Fraggles, and then you had a long shot of them in CG stalking along like,
But they did that in the, what did they call it, Wide Blue Yonder, didn't they, when their arms were suddenly growing long, and you thought, oh, that's got to be...
Oh, yeah, and they'd made a gigantic hand.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's incredible, and even sets that you think are CG. On the Imagine thing, when they're giving Anyentum a tour of the studios, they're going into these sets and I'm thinking, they built that? That wasn't on a computer? That's crazy.
If you've ever seen the any of the extras on the DVDs for Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings thing, nearly all the big towers in the cities were actually enormous miniature models rather than CGI things. And I love things like that.
Well, I mean, one of the classic ones of that was the model of Gotham City in Tim Burton's Batman. That was an amazing model.
Oh, really? Was that a...
Yeah, that's a model. There's some great photographs of that. So I love it when they do that. I think it just works so much better.
I think I've run out of things to say.
Well...
What?
Anyone have anything to say?
No, I think I pretty much said everything I wanted to say about the episode, I think.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
Would you say you could see the money?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, even more so on watching the behind-the-scenes stuff. Like we were just saying, a lot of time and effort has gone into making these costumes and props and puppets, and a lot of money has been spent on matching the CG. It's stunning. It's just unbelievable. It's really good. And you've got even good things like you've got these beautiful drone shots now, haven't you? They're actually... You've got some of those distance shots of the church in the snow. Was just stunning.
Yeah, and I really love... I know it's very simple, but the overhead crane shot of the TARDIS as Ruby walks around the outside of it. Really nice. Yeah.
Isn't there a rumour they're going to redesign the Daleks for this?
Well, I mean, you said they've been arrested... But I don't believe that for one little bit.
Oh, who said that? I'm not seeing that.
Russell T. Davies has said that. He feels that they're going to be arrested, that there's new monsters and new stories to tell. And I've always had that thing that when you think about the size of the Tom Baker era and the percentage of new monsters to old monsters, it was like, it was all fresh. Maybe they want that, I don't know. But it's a design classic, is the Dalek. You've got to be really careful.
Yeah. I mean, they saw when they... And no one official ever admits it, but those paradigm Daleks were an absolute disaster, weren't they?
They were, but I've touched one, and they're quite glossy and shiny and exciting. But, yeah, it's the wrong silhouette. I think they got it right in 2005. I quite liked the ones we ended up with at the end of the Geordie thing. The ones that were being printed when the government were printing 3D printing.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I don't think they were too bad, but you can't mess with them too much. There are some things you can't mess with.
No, not at all.
No, some new colours would be nice, as we said earlier.
Yeah, I mean, the grey and black ones on that video, they look great. Yeah, but give us some different colours. One with a different eye stalk. Stick a torch on it. That's what you may do within the 70s. No, but it was all right.
So, shall we give it a marks out of 10?
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
I would give it... I would give it a 9.5.
Whew. Wow.
Wow. That's big.
That is big. See, I was going to go with 7 because I just think it's a good episode. It did what it needs to do, and there's better and presumably worse to come. So I'm going for a 7.
I think there are aspects of it that are worth a really high grade, which are the things like Shooty, like Millie, like the look of the whole thing. But again, those things are yet to come and bear more fruit. I think I would go with an 8.
Despite what I said about the realisation of the goblins, I thought they were, I wasn't that enamoured of them, so maybe... No, I'll give it a 9. As faithless listeners across the globe pick themselves off the floor and sit down again, expect me to give it a 2 or something. What new era can have dawned? The listeners ask themselves in wonder. Oh, brave new podcast that has such scores in it. Well, Rev, it's been a wonderful 10th birthday treat seeing you here.
Mm-hmm.
Have those candles burnt out yet? Actually, that fire extinguisher on your mark.
There you go.
Thanks. Right, let's tuck in. And I do hope that we shall see you again.
Oh, yes. You can guarantee you can see me another 10 years ago.
Right, so... I've just realised... We've got no Hayden, have we? So we can't have Uncle Terence saying goodbye to us.
Well, no.
No, hang on. The first person to do...
Riff used to do an Uncle Terence, didn't you?
Yes, you did. Give us a bit of Uncle Terence, Rev.
Well, the story is that we went to an event in Bradford to meet Terence Dix and Destiny of the Daleks to be signed. And to pass time on the train, I read from it in the style of...
Of course!
Uncle Terence. And he was on the train, sat near us. And didn't look at me when he signed my book. But years later, at another event, we made friends, which was good. So he obviously forgotten me. But he thought very much like that. The what colourful monsters in green. The goblins, they were green. And I was right. And I invented new who.
Uncle Terence. People across the nation have passed out from hearing us give high scores for a Doctor Who episode. What shall we do with their bodies?
They'll dump bodies in the river.
Uncle Terence, we have cloned impressionists in Sector 47.
It's a trap!
This Uncle Terence seems incredibly moist. Must be all that birthday cake he's been eating.
Oh, was that the letterbox? Oh, it's an envelope. Ooh, it's a Memorex C60 audio cassette from Hayden. Let's put it in the tape recorder and leave it playing for the listeners. Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
I have to confess, dear listeners, that I didn't listen to Diddly Dum right from the word go, not from the first day, but a few months after the podcast had launched. I was working a job in Cambridge, and it was one of those jobs where you can sort of just plug your headset in and just go up. Basically, it was data entry. I'm trying to overglorify it, but no, it was just data entry. And I sat there and I was going through Doctor Who podcasts, looking at some that are coming up. And I'd heard on another podcast, Diddly Dum, named several times. And the first podcast I came across for Diddly Dum was The Six Stages of Fandom, which I thought was, I've got to be honest with you, I thought was actually genius. The way of splitting it up into, I mean, at the point I'd have been about 23 or 24 probably. 24, I think. So I hadn't quite got through all of the stages just yet they were talking about. I was probably on the fourth or fifth, but I found it very, very relatable at the time. And ever since then, I really enjoyed it. Loved listening to the podcast, listening to Al Know, Doc Whom and The Rev every 2 weeks. And then just after Christmas 2014, I got a message from... God, actually, I'm just trying to think now. It probably would have been about January 2015, I'd say, when Doc messaged me saying that, would I like to become a presenter? And it was in a week where I just moved into my first place alone. I'd rented a flat in a nearby town to where I grew up. First time I had money and the first time I had a job that was stable enough for me to just go live somewhere on my own. And about 3 days after moving in, I was podcasting for Diddly Dum. And throughout that time period, I've met so many wonderful people, either through the Capital conventions, through the podcast, and obviously through the podcast, the listeners as well. And after 100 episodes, well over 100 episodes, and is it something like 4 or 5 other regular podcasters I think I've presented with in the time, obviously we come to the 10th anniversary. It's an astonishing feat, especially in a world where podcasts come and go almost on a monthly basis or take very long breaks. And I know it's the pot calling the kettle black here, but yeah, or they take very long breaks and then you just get out of the routine of listening to them. But Diddly Dum has always been there. It's been a constant from that moment where I was, for my first time in a flat, it was there where I had major upheaval in my family. It was there when I first met my now wife. It was there when my son was born, and it's been there while I'm waiting for my daughter to be born, which is quite incredible. And all along that while, there's been one constant on Diddly Dum, and that has been Doc Hume, who really does deserve the biggest pat on the back and the biggest pangalactic gargle blaster that you can find for the amount of work that he's put into it for a decade now. He's been there right from the start, and without him, I never would have got to meet so many lovely listeners and have so many wonderful adventures with them. And then, of course, there's the friendships which have been made along the way. You've had Alan, Matt Charlton, Doc, and, of course, gentle Welsh Mark. We've had many adventures together, and their friendships are invaluable, as they are, of course, with you, the listeners. I mean, you may have noticed that, to be honest, if you're a regular listener, you're probably actually thinking, who's this idiot talking right now? He's never on the podcast. But if you're a regular listener, obviously I haven't really been around since last May. Life's got incredibly busy. Now with a second child on the way as well, I've hung my podcasting keys up, I'm afraid. And I'm really looking forward to listening to what the Doc and Mark and future presenters get up to. I may send messages in like this every now and then when I get a chance. I don't want to be completely out of the loop because it's been a huge part of my life. And you, listeners, have been a huge part of my life as well. And I just want to take this opportunity to say happy birthday, Diddly Dum. Thank you and goodbye. Hopefully see you soon.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Facebook and Mastodon at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum, it is liquid podcasting. Stick it in your ear, old sunshine.